We want to thank you for listening today. This audio sermon is a ministry of Faith Baptist Church, a place where you belong. Now let's listen to the message of truth from God's Word.
I appreciate all your prayers about my health issues. I knew back in February that I had cancer. I had a son that was getting married, and I found out the week before he got married. So we had to kind of just get through that wedding before we did a whole lot. And so I then went to Mayo for treatment, and the doctor said, I can't really do anything for you for a few months. He said, we just got to kind of let this play out. And I said, any big issues? He goes, no, you're going to die anyways. I can't do anything about that. He said, you're just probably not going to die from this. And so I said, okay, you're my guy. If you can keep me from dying from this, that's good. And so I got into this habit. My wife said, hey, can you help me do this? I said, sorry, I can't. I got cancer. And it worked for about 6 months. And now people like Todd tell people I'm cancer-free. Now I don't have any excuses anymore. I have to actually really do things. So I'm back working and enjoying life. So that's good. And then the meeting today was really effective. Most of you know that Chad grew up in our church. That's a good thing, right? And we were talking about strategy. One of the things that we have committed to as a church is that we actually state this, that we want to be willing to send our best and brightest away from our church out in ministry. So you want to know why this church is so good? Our best and brightest are right over there. So anyways, that's a lot of fun. I love your staff. I love the church. I tell you this all the time. I preach here more than I preach any place besides our own church. Here and at Word of Life. And so kind of between the two, I'm here quite a bit, and I always enjoy seeing the progress. I think going to three services and executing it as well as you have has really been good. And I think it'll, if you'll, that 10 o'clock service will grow if you don't do anything. It just will. One service always does. If you'll be intentional about inviting guests to 8:30 and 11:30, they will grow in proportional as a 10. You have to work at those a little harder because, after all, who really is thinking about church at 8:30 in the morning on Sunday, right? And then 11:30, I wouldn't go to the 11:30 service, okay? I'd be too hungry by that time. But somebody's got to go to it, right? We need the space, so somebody's got to go. So eat good breakfast and then go to brunch afterwards, right? You can do it that way. But really work out. I think it's such a good thing. I'm really excited about where you're at. And I see incredible progress, really, really helpful. So turn to Psalm 3, if you would, tonight. And I have been doing a bunch of teaching really kind of intermittently throughout Psalms and Proverbs over the last couple of years. And these are subjects that are familiar. So this is not going to be a new subject to you. But they're subjects that help us. A lot of times we talk about the Christian life in terms of things that we need to do, okay? And there's nothing wrong with that. There's things that you ought to do. You ought to create practices and disciplines in your life. Those are incredibly important. But there's also things that you have to do that are not so much outward. They're not so much activity. They're about building a strong and credible inner life. And you have an outer life and you have an inner life. And you're building an outer life. You're building an outer life by your job and your career and your friendships and all of the things, your family. You're really doing things to build your relationships. Those are all building the outer life. But you have this invisible side of you. It's the side of you that doesn't always get put on display, maybe with the people that are closest to you, but not necessarily with everybody. And you've got this inner life going on. And you have to do things in the inner life. In fact, if you do not have a way to deal, I think in this context, with your problems, then life itself, because of its circumstances, will oftentimes cause you to be depleted and exhausted. We all get that way. And unless you have a mechanism for dealing with those, life is going to get incredibly overwhelming. One of the most interesting things about the poetic books, and so you have Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Solomon, five poetic books. They're in the middle of the Old Testament. Every other book, if you take the 66 books in the Bible, 61 out of the 66 are largely written from a vertical perspective. It is God, through the Spirit of God, giving to man a message that tells us, for example, in history, God's view of history in the historical books. Or in the New Testament, God's record about his son in the Gospels, or God's record about the church in the book of Acts. When you come to the Psalms, the table's flipped. And while they're still as inspired by God, you get a lot of man looking up at God, or really man going through some incredibly difficult things and expressing the way that we respond to our difficulties and try to reconcile them with what we know about God. That's what you have here in the book of Psalms. In fact, you could actually, there's a way that you can do this. You can pray the Psalms, and in praying the Psalms, you will pray through your emotions, those things that trouble you. And we all have to deal with emotions. And today we're going to deal with the emotion of fear. And fear can be a powerful emotion. Fear, for some of us, can be periodic in our life. And for others, we're riddled by fear, and we carry it with us all life long. My wife and I travel some. We don't always travel together, not because we don't like each other, but sometimes we go in different directions. When I travel by myself, I have a goal. So this is, you know, I'm really kind of, this is me. You get to know me a little bit. My goal is to never take more than what I'm going to wear. It's a win for me if I get home and I wore everything that I took. It's actually a win for me if I can wear everything I took twice and my wife not get on to me for it. Right? I mean, that right? So when we travel, you know, my backpack, which is a briefcase, is like this big, right? And my travel case with my stuff is like this big. When she and I travel together, let me just say it very kindly, her stuff's bigger than my stuff. Because she has no such goal, right? So oftentimes we go into airports, and you know what I'm doing? I'm carrying her baggage because it's too heavy for her, and she's carrying my baggage because it's the right size. You with me? Some of you have all your emotions in baggage. Some of you have very tall or very small emotional baggage. I mean, you can just throw it in almost an invisible bag, and you can just kind of wear it, and nobody would even know you have it. And others of you have such emotional baggage. I mean, you look like you're a luggage store Samsonite moving in every time you move. Now, I've been pastoring long enough. I've been pastoring 27 years. When I see people with emotional baggage at the front door of the church office, I find a back door to go in. You following me? Now, we have to have a way of dealing with emotion. We have to have a way to process the things that happen to us. We have to have a way to make sense in the inner part of your life. Now, when you think about inner life, that's where the real you exists. That's the part of you that you're probably very hesitant to make known to others. You may make that part of you known to people that are close to you, but you're not apt to or likely to make that part known to people that you're not comfortable with. David does something that's almost unthinkable in humanity. He, through the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, puts his emotional baggage on display. Look at Psalm 3. He says here in verse number 1, Lord, how are they increased that trouble me? Many are they that rise up against me. Many there be which say of my soul, there's no help for him and God. And then you have this Hebrew word. It's the word Selah. It is designed to be interjected into the scripture. It's as if the writer wants to say, stop and think about that for a moment. He wants you to come to a full stop. People say, God has completely abandoned him. Stop. Think about that for a minute. Then he goes on, verse number 3. But thou, Lord, art a shield for me, my glory, and the lifter up of my head. I cried unto the Lord with my voice, and he heard me out of his holy hill, Selah. Stop there. Just because people say God has abandoned you doesn't mean that's true. Right? It feels sometime to be true, right? But here's what faith does. Faith has a sight that goes beyond the physical. And faith says that what may appear to be true may not actually be true. We don't walk by faith, what appears to be true, we walk by sight, what is actually true. What appears to be true is God's abandoned me. What's actually true, God's still hearing me. God hasn't forsaken me, God hasn't forgotten me. I will not be afraid, or I laid me down and slept. I wake, and the Lord sustained me. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people that have set themselves against me round about. Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God, for thou hast smitten all my enemies upon the cheekbone. Thou hast broken the teeth of the ungodly. Salvation belongeth unto the Lord. Thy blessing is upon thy people, Selah. Now, different people have a different way of dealing with emotions. If you have this outline tonight that they prepared for you, I'm going to give you four little statements, and it will help you to kind of get your mind around how we deal with or process fear. Religious people. Now, I'm going to use that term, and let me explain it to you so that it doesn't become confusing to you. There's moral people, religious people, and there's secular people. Christians tend neither to be religious or secular. They tend to be Christian. But we will act more like religious people when we slip into what I call a moralism or a moral view about life. Here's what religious people do with fear. Religious people deny or stuff their emotions. We don't like to admit weaknesses. We struggle with saying things are wrong. In fact, you ask the average Christian in church on a Sunday, how are things going? They're likely to say something like this: couldn't be better. God is good. Everything's great. Well, the reality is their whole life may be falling apart, right? But they're not about to let you know it. All right? So they have a tendency to stuff their emotions. Secular people express their emotions. Have you heard of, so do any of you get on Twitter? Little? Few? All right, do you know what social media outrage is? Like, people go on social media and they just do these mind dumps, right? And whatever happens, they're outraged at everything, right? Typically, it's not Christian moral people that are doing that. You know what it is? It's secular people that the way that they deal with fear, apprehension, insecurity of life, they just express outrage about everything. You know, you talk. I had a lady in my office this week, and she said, you know, I'm just going to give you a piece of my mind. I said, do you want me to keep it, or do you want me to let you take it with you when you leave? She said, okay, don't be funny. I said, well, I just wondered, you know, what do you want me to do with it, right? See, people just want to dump it out. And by the way, they oftentimes are doing it because they're trying to alleviate the pain of the inner life, okay? Then you have women. Now, this is not meant to be derogatory. I looked at this, and when I teach at home, people understand me, and I'm not being derogatory. But let me just tell you what women tend to do with fear, okay? Women, when it comes to fear, they deal with insecurity in the inner life by obsessive focus on the outer life. Now, if you think I'm being derogatory, wait a minute, I'm going to tell you what men do, and it's worse, okay? So that's a default behavior, right? So what happens to us is if we don't want to deal with pain, we focus obsessively on something else, right? We get fixated on something else. That doesn't make the problem go away. It just masks it, right? here's what men do. They have this macho attitude about their true feelings. So women are, you know, focusing on the opposite. They don't go in or they go out. Or here's what men do. They just act like idiots, right? They try to bluff their way. When inside, they're feeling this great deal of insecurity. Here's what we would say about all of these feelings. They're complex realities. I had a guy in my office this week. He is successful, owns a business, makes a good deal of money, and he's stressed. He said, I cannot describe to you the level of stress that I'm feeling in my life. And literally, he said, can you help me? I said, yeah. I said, let's do this. I said, how about just take a really deep breath? I said, stop for a minute. Anything that you're worrying about right now, has it ever come true? He goes, no. I said, okay, well, let's stop worrying about those things because they're not likely to ever come true. Right? And here's what I told him. I said, look, your life has become very complex, and you don't have a way of dealing with the complex realities of your inner life. And you've got to have a system. You've got to have a process. You've got to have a worldview that allows you to get it. That's what's happening in David's life. He's king. He's ascended to incredible power. He's the most powerful man in the nation where he lives. He's representing not only the people to God, he's representing God to the people. You talk about pressure, right? He's living under it. And we know that as he goes through this experience, Psalm 3 is written at a time when Absalom, his son, is trying to overthrow the throne of David. He's trying to take his place. And so he's got family trouble and he's got nation trouble. Listen, it's bad when you get trouble at work. It's really bad when you get trouble at work and home, right? And so now he's dealing with the complexities of the inner life. He doesn't know what to do and he becomes deeply emotional. He can't sleep, right? You ever been so fearful you couldn't even fall asleep? He can't rationalize. He can't see a clear path forward. And so he takes his fears and he begins to pray through his fears. That's what Psalm 3 is. It's a prayer of fears. He prays his fears in order to be able to master them. We need to learn to master our inner life. We need to learn to master our emotions, to master our fears. Let's talk about that real quick. First of all, let's talk about the complexity of fear, the complexity of fear. Do you know that not all fear is bad? In reality, fear can be a good thing, right? So the other day, I was trying to get back into, had surgery in May, trying to get back into kind of normal life routines, and I thought, well, I'm just going to go to the golf course and see if I can walk 9 holes. I called my son-in-law. I thought he was going to go with me. He said, hey, I can't meet you right now. But he said, I'll meet you a little bit later. I said, okay, I'm just going to start walking, and I'm going to start playing. And I was thinking about, you know, it's hot. I don't want to be out in the heat too long. And I was thinking about how can I do this in a quick kind of way where I wasn't there. And I was kind of taking shortcuts as I was playing, and I saw this big snake. You know, my first thought, my mom is terrified of snakes. Every time I see a snake, I have this vivid picture. I remember my younger brother had a shoelace in one hand and a shoe in the other hand. He was like 4 years old, and he was trying to get my mom to help him put the shoelace back in the shoe because he pulled it out. All my mom could see was him holding the shoelace. She took off out of the kitchen, out the back door, and is running around the house. And here's my brother, 4 years old, chasing her with his shoestring. I'm thinking, doesn't she know this just a shoestring? She's terrified of snakes, right? Fear can be a good thing, right? Now, I know enough about snakes to tell you which kind are poisonous and which kind are not poisonous. I can also tell you enough that I'm not trustworthy. I don't trust my own ability to know that well enough that I'm going to stay far away from them, right? I have a healthy fear of prescription medicine, because I've dealt with enough people that have had problems with prescription medicine. You can give me pain medication, I'm not taking it, right? Ibuprofen will do it for me every time. There's healthy fear in your life. Do you understand what that is? But there's also unhealthy fear. There's negative fear, and that fear can plague you. We all have fears. We all have, here's the Greek word for it, it's phobias. Do you know what a phobia is? Do you know what pelidophobia is? Pelidophobia is fear of baldness and fear of bald people. Aerophobia is fear of drafts. Porphyrophobia is the fear of the color purple. Chatophobia is the fear of hairy people. You're easy to preach to. You laugh about anything. Levophobia is fear of objects on the left side of your body, right? And dextrophobia is fear of objects on the right side of your body. Aurorophobia is the fear of the northern lights. Calipophobia is the fear of obscure meetings, like the word calipophobia. Thalassophobia is the fear of being seated. Stabis basis phobia is the fear of standing. Odontophobia is the fear of teeth. Graphophobia is the fear of written objects or the fear of writing in public. And then phobophobia is just the fear of being afraid. Now, you say, well, that's a kind of a weird list. Well, it just shows you we have fear of all sorts of things, and most of the time for no valid reason, right? So where does fear come from, all right? So just write this down. This is not in your outline, but it's good to know. Fear is a primal emotion, okay? And you have primal emotions. And so when somebody says to you, stop being afraid, you actually can't stop being afraid because you're born with this primal emotion of fear. It's inside of every one of us. So it's not stop being afraid. It's learn to master the fear that you were born with. You want me to teach you or explain to you why it's a primal emotion? You're born with it. Think about a child. What's the first thing that a child does when he's born? Cries. He's not crying tears of joy. Right? He's not crying because he has doubts. He's not crying because he thinks that the political system in America has just totally gone haywire. He's not crying because of all the mounting challenges he's going to have in going through school for, you know, 18 years once he turns 5 years old. You know why he's crying? He's crying because in one moment he's in this really incredibly safe place and it's warm, right? And everything is provided for him. And all of a sudden, he's thrust into this completely sterile world that's incredibly cold, right? And people start doing to him things that he could never imagine that anybody would ever do to him. And he feels all alone, even though he's surrounded by people and he has no idea who they are. And oftentimes they don't settle down until the doctor and nurses clean the baby up and do what with the baby? They give the baby back to the mother, the one object, the one person that the baby recognizes, and the baby begins to calm down because he's born with this primal emotion of fear. So now, if your husband has a fear or if your wife has a fear, don't belittle them. They're born with it. And it's very complex for them to have to deal and process with the fear in their life. So here's two kinds of fear and how they affect you. David is acting out of primal emotions in his life as his world is changing and his world is coming apart. He feels like he's losing control. So he's referring to his fear here, the awful dread and terrifying circumstances because of what's happening in his life circumstantially and relationally. Two things about the complexity of fear. First of all, fear, because it has a positive side, can be energizing. Fear can be incredibly energizing. He faced this external physical threat. You actually see it in verse number one. He said, how are they increased that trouble me? Many are they that rise up against me. If you go back and read what happens, the background for this passage, in 2 Samuel chapter 15, beginning in 15 and all the way through chapter 18, one of David's closest friends, one of David's most trusted confidants describes David this way. He is like a bear who's been robbed of his whelps. That's the wording that's used. You know what that means? Have you ever watched, I hope you've never seen it personally or up front and close, but have you ever watched a documentary of a bear that's been surprised by humans, and the cubs are within distance of the. You know what that bear does? I mean, it is instantly energized, and it attacks. It lashes out. All of its fear causes it to move to action. Fear can be energizing. I do not make a recommendation that you live your life out of the energy of fear. I do say at times that fear of losing a job, fear of losing a spouse, fear of losing a child, fear of loss of something can cause you to be highly motivated. All David's senses began to work. His mind was sharp. He was prepared to do what was necessary to preserve his life and to maintain his position. That fear released adrenaline into his body, and it caused his mind to be sharpened so that he was able to meet his challenges. Fear can, but is not always healthy and energizing. Fear is not only energizing, but fear can be overwhelming. What typically happens is after the onslaught of fear in your life, the energizing influence of fear goes, you're left with this overwhelming sense of fear. And that's the negative side of it. And you begin to contemplate loss. In fact, what David is doing is he's contemplating, what becomes of me if Absalom wins? Will I have any meaning? Will I have any purpose? Will there be any at all justification for anything that's happened up to this point in my life? He's beginning to get at now what is the real source of his fear. His fear is all of his value has come from what he does. He's king. In fact, he's such a special king that God even describes him in one way that he's a man after God's own heart. He's adored by his people. They sang songs about him, remember? Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. They had these incredible things that they would say about David. And David is thinking, hey, wait a minute. If I lose this, I lose that. If I lose this, I lose everything. And fear can cause you to think that what you have, what you're trusting in, what you're holding on to is the sole reason of your worth. And David is having to learn that his worth is not in his inner life. It's not in the things that he has. His worth is in God. That's the complexity of fear. Let's talk about, secondly, the cause of fear. So when you get to this idea of fear, think about how David is dealing with this. In David's case, like most people, when they deal with fear as an inner emotion, there's something that's at the root of that. I'll explain it to you quickly. I don't want to dwell on this for a long time. I want to get to the application. But at the root of fear, first of all, is an identity crisis. Look at verse 2. He says, many there be which say of my soul, there is no help for him in God, Selah. David knew that his enemies were casting doubt on his calling to be their king by putting his character under attack. What they were saying is that they believed that God had abandoned him. Now, think about this. Have you noticed how we oftentimes, and I think you see it, I'm not going to overly make over much commentary on political matters, but do you know how we compare current presidents with past presidents, right? And we have a tendency to look back and say, well, it happened to them and it's going to happen to him, or it's happening to him and it happened to them. Well, there was only two kings really up to this point in Israel. There were other leaders, but two kings. There was Saul and there was David. What happened with Saul is that you remember God took his anointing, that's the term that's used in 1 Samuel 15, off from Saul. It's really saying this, God abandoned Saul. God rejected Saul. The people knew it. By the way, Saul knew it. David knew it. Samuel knew it. Everybody knew it. Now they're turning that same thing and they're saying, hey, you remember what happened to Saul? Same things happened to David. God rejected Saul. God has abandoned David. And David is starting to think, I wonder if that's really true. He is facing the reality that the people are calling into question whether God is with him, and now they are attacking what's at the core of his identity, because what had happened here to David, he no longer was a shepherd that was doing things, right, for God out of passion for solely God's glory. He was actually doing things because he liked being king. You know, when I talk to pastors, and I say this to them because they can say it to me, I always remind pastors of this. If you can't be you without being a pastor, then you're in an unhealthy place being a pastor. If your identity is more in being a pastor than it is in being a child of God, you're an unhealthy pastor. And it's the same for you. If your identity is something other than being a child of God, then you have an unhealthy identity. You're going to hit an identity crisis, because if you lose that thing, you feel like you lose everything. What this is actually teaching us, and I'll show you this in a moment, that David's identity was tied to his role as a dad. His identity was tied to his role as a king. He's in danger of losing his son. He's in danger of losing his kingdom and everything that he's glorying in. He's losing his grip on. Okay? That's a cause of fear. It's an identity crisis. Secondly, fear, at the root of fear, is insecurity. Now, if you take identity crisis and you go into the next level of emotional complexity, when you find your security in something and you lose it, it's what makes you unhealthy. It's what causes you to become nervous. It's what causes you to be anxious. It's what causes you to have high blood pressure. Now, I don't want to imply that all I ever do is talk to people who have difficult problems. I do deal a lot with people, high success people, people that run businesses, have a lot of things going on. And it's funny how when they get to places of real insecurity, they will oftentimes feel safe in talking to me and telling me how they're feeling. I talked to a guy the other day, and he said, I can't sleep. I said, why? He said, I have so much business out. He said, people owe me hundreds of thousands of dollars. He said, I'm tired of worrying about it. He said, what do I do? I said, well, I got a solution. He said, what's that? I said, just call them and tell them they don't have to pay you. He said, but I want the money. I said, well, then you better find a different way. I said, here's the problem. You've attached your identity with the money, right? And if your identity's in the money, then you're only going to be happy if you get the money, and you're worried about not getting the money. You got to put your glory in something else. Or it's going to plague you to no end. Insecurity comes when you place your trust in things that can be taken from you. Follow me. Security comes when you put your faith in things that will never change. So I don't like to talk about this a lot, not for any bad reason. I just don't want you to think better of me than you should. And I'm serious about that. But, you know, people said to me, why doesn't it bother you when you find out you had cancer? Because my whole hope wasn't, I never put my whole hope in that I was going to be healthy all of my life. Right? There's always been the possibility for me, and there's the possibility for you, that there's some things you can't control. Now, there are some things you can control. And you better put your faith, your trust, you better put at the center of your life things that can never be taken away from you. My health can be taken away from me. My relationship with God can never be taken away from me. So my relationship with God trumps anything in my life that can be taken from me. Do you get that? And if you put your trust in things that you can lose, then you're always, you're only subject to how secure, that's what makes you insecure, how secure the things you put your trust in. Right? And if you let go of the things that are not guaranteed, if you put those things in the hands of God, you don't have insecurity. you can make it. That's what happens to us. That's what causes us to have the insecurity. When you find your glory, when you find the thing that you've put your trust in the most, you find the idol of the heart. And when you find the idol of the heart, you find out what's at the source of your fear. Number three, let's talk about the cure for fear. So there is, I'll tell you two little tricks. You want two little tricks about studying the Psalms? There's two key ways to unpack Psalms. Typically, one of two things will be true. If it's a narrative that tells a story where the writer is expressing what's going on in his inner life, and then the narrative changes and he talks about how things change for him and his perspective changed, there's usually going to be some phrase that goes like this, but, or as for me, okay? So what you have is you have what we call a crisis point or a turning point in the narrative, and he turns away from his problem and he's going to turn towards God. The other way is you usually take the first verse of a psalm and the last verse of the psalm and you bookend them together, and what you find in the first verse is problematic is answered in the last verse, and you can usually bookend those together. Here, you find in verse number 3, there's, but thou, O Lord. So verses 1 and 2 tells me what my problem is. Verse 3 begins to point me to my solution. David is actually saying, but thou, Lord, in other words, I refuse to let my fears control my inner life. Let me say this to some of you. You don't have to live controlled by fear and insecurity. Now, if you never do anything about your fear or your insecurity, it will plague you. But if you begin to turn away from that and turn towards God, you get these but thou, O Lord, moments in your life, and you get to the place where you begin to master your fear. Let me show this to you. There's four steps that solve the crisis of fear in your life. I'll show them to you. First of all, you're fearful. First, move forward in the will of God. Look what he says in verse 3. But thou, O Lord, art a shield for me, my glory, and the lifter up of my head. There's two types of shields in the Bible. There's the shield that you see literally in Ephesians. It talks about the shield of faith, right? And the shield of faith is like an arm shield. It's a shield that you can use to deflect that which the enemy is throwing at you. The other kind of shield is the one that is more associated with what became, by the New Testament, the modern day iteration of the Roman army. They would have these large doors. The shields were so big, and the shields were interlocking with the shields of the people next to them. So if we were going into battle and we had a unit of 40 or 50 men, as we went into battle, we would all take our big shields and we would move forward and we'd all get to a place and we'd stop, and then our shields could interlock, right? And we could actually create walls, sides, roofs, and we'd have a front, a side, and a top to protect us. Right? And the only way that you would advance is you would advance behind the shield. Here's what David is saying. God, I can't turn around and run. I'd be dead. I'd be exposed. I'd be overthrown. I can keep moving forward, but I'm just going to move forward, not in my own strength. I'm going to move forward in the will of God. And I realize that if I don't, because the shield is in front of me, confront my fears head on, I'm going to be overwhelmed. And there's a lot of people, they're paralyzed because of their fear. Fear should never paralyze you. It should cause you to go directly forward in the will of God. Keep going in the direction God wants you to go. That's how you overcome your fear. Number two, reassess where your security is placed. Notice what it says here in verse number 3. It says, but thou, O Lord, art a shield for me, semicolon, my glory, and the lifter up of my head. That's a different expression. He's saying that he learned that his glory was not in the position of being king, And it wasn't even in the position of being dad. And by the way, let me stop and insert this. There's a lot of parents that you are actually suffering because you've put your whole entire hope on how well your kids behave. Right? In fact, you can experience it like this. You know what happens when you become a parent, right? You forfeit the right to ever be happy again. Because if your kids ain't happy, you ain't happy. Is that true? You know why? Because our hope, our security, is wrapped up in the performance and the well-being and the happiness of our kids. And David is actually having to extricate himself from that. He says, wait a minute, my kids aren't my glory. Being king isn't my glory. I'm actually failing. I'm not a very good dad, and I'm really at this moment not a very good king. So what is he doing? He's relocating. He's putting his trust, his hope, his glory, not in things that are vulnerable to time and space. Follow me. I know this is hard to get your mind wrapped around. If things that are located in time and space, if they're anything, you know what they are? They're vulnerable to things that are in time or space. So you have to put your glory in things that are not subject to time and space. You have to put your glory in things that are infinite. And when you shift your glory away from time and space things and you put them into the infinite God, then you begin to understand that God is your glory. He is your honor. He's the one that secures your reputation. And with that, God lifts up your head and says to you, hey, you're good not because of what you do. You're good because of what I do. You don't actually have to perform in order to be good with me. This is what God's saying. God reassures us with his unconditional love, and he validates our worth. That's what it means to have your head lifted up, that you can actually look up and see, you can pick up your head and know that God doesn't reject you. Now get that for a moment. You know why people struggle? Because they have a fear of what other people think about them. But when you know that you are defined by your relationship with God, then it doesn't matter what people think about you. You have nothing to fear. So you make God your security. Number three, you need to see the sacrifice that God made for us. So it's easy to kind of miss this in verse number four, but he says, I cried unto the Lord with my voice, and he heard me out of his holy hill, Selah. So invariably, particularly in psalms that deal with emotions, there will come a point where the psalmist will think, or he'll recollect, and he'll oftentimes talk about the temple, or he'll talk about the holy place, or he'll talk about the holy hill. To Jerusalem, and to the Israelites, the term holy hill simply referred to Mount Moriah. Mount Moriah was where the tabernacle was built. Mount Moriah is where the temple would be built. Mount Moriah is where, do you remember the story of Abraham and Isaac? Remember that? And Isaac was brought up to Mount Moriah by Abraham, and God asked Abraham obediently to offer up his son as a sacrifice. What this is actually doing is it's causing you to see that David is actually reprocessing, and he's thinking this through. He looked to the holy hill. He's thinking about what happened on that hill. And he's going to see that there was a substitute that would make this possible. In fact, what David is doing is he's acknowledging that though he has failed in every way, he can still lay down and sleep. He does not have to be bothered by his failure, because God actually has a solution for your failure. This will really help you. Can I tell you something? You do not have to be perfect. God has a solution for your imperfection. See, if David couldn't get over the fact that he had failed, see, is it okay to say this? Can I say, I'm not a perfect pastor. Now, I'm probably about as close as you can come to being one. You saw right through that, didn't you? Do you see what he's doing? He's saying, I'm not near as good as I thought I was, and I'm finally admitting to you what I really need is a solution for all the failure in my life. And there is a solution. It's in the holy hill. God has a plan to deal with the failure in your life. What's that plan? Well, there's a place in Genesis 15 where God comes to Abraham and he says, "Do not be afraid." He says, "I am your shield and I am your glory." And in that, he says, "Abraham, I'm going to give you an oath. I'm going to make you a promise." In fact, he causes Abraham to fall asleep, and then God walks among the parts of a divided animal, Genesis 15, and he makes a covenant promise with Abraham, and David is claiming that promise through Abraham, and he's actually saying this: God, you have a hill, a place where you're going to walk among the divided sacrifice. You are going to be the sacrifice that is torn apart, that's going to take away all my sin and all of my failure, and all of my security is not rooted in what I do, it's in what you're going to do for me. That gets rid of your fear. Because you can actually stand before God, and you're going to stand before him with an absolutely impeccable record. Not yours, but the record of Jesus. And you get the record of Jesus because of what he did for you on the cross. You see that? Then number four, you have to move into a relationship with others. Now, If you just let me finish with this, it'll make sense to you, and I'll make a quick application. If you look at the first several verses, you see that there's this incredible individual focus on David's life, David's problem, David's circumstances, right? In fact, if you think about it, it's almost selfish. It's about what he's going to lose. It's never about what his family's going to lose. It's never about what his people, his nation's going to lose. It's about what he's going to lose. When he gets this whole thing reverted and he gets it reoriented, he says in verse number 7, "Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God, for thou hast smitten all mine enemies upon the cheekbone. Thou hast broken the teeth of the ungodly. Salvation belongeth to the Lord, and thy blessing is upon," now watch this, "thy people." He turns from an inward individual focus to a community focus. He actually sees that what happens in my life, the blessing that I'm looking for in my life, is not a blessing I'm trying to get for me. It's a blessing I'm trying to get for us. You actually need to be in relationships with people. If you forget that you're involved in community or relationship with others, you become self-centered and isolated. Self-centeredness and isolation only exacerbates and exaggerates your fears. It always does. Living in community with others always mitigates and minimizes your fears. That's why you need, when your pastor talks about you need to get in group life, you need to be in group life. Now, will that be the best experience you have? Maybe not. It may only meet 10 or 15% of the emotional needs that you have. But getting 10 or 15% of your emotional needs met, that's a huge thing. And maybe if you get involved in the choir, there's another 10 or 15%, or the children's ministry, or the nursery, or whatever else it is, or the hospitality ministry, and you get faithful in a church service, and you start meeting people, and you develop friends, and before you know it, you don't have one thing that you're putting all your hope in. You've got a lot of healthy relationships, and healthy relationships with people help to give you strength to deal with the emotional insecurities that you have. But try taking that baggage, remember that big suitcase full of emotional baggage, and just try to handle it all by yourself the rest of your life. It'll wear you out, right? It'll absolutely drain you. You're either going to be controlled by fear or you're going to be controlled by your faith in God. God has a plan for you. God's not going to waste one adversity, one bit of suffering, one problem that you face in life, he's going to use it to shape you. Every one of us has things that we value and treasure, and if we stand to lose them, whether it be a house, a job, a relationship, a friend, a family member, a career, or a reputation, we'll struggle with fear. the more danger we are in losing those things, the more we'll struggle with fears. So you relocate your glory to the Father. You find in his sacrifice your identity and security. And when that happens, you know what you do? You lay down at night and you go to sleep. And you awake because you're sustained by the righteousness of God. You're sustained because God brings healing to your inner life, right? There are people that are really that are building really big outer lives. I talk to them all the time. They have dreams and plans and goals, careers. And I tell them, I said, while you're building an outer life, you better build an inner life that can sustain the complexity of your outer life, because if you don't, you'll build an outer life that will eventually crush your inner life. And there's a lot of people with big outer lives and crushed inner lives, and they never enjoy their outer life. You know, God's saying, come to me, trust me, find me to be your glory, center your life on me, and see how I help you to process the emotions, the inner life.
Thank you again for listening to this audio sermon. We pray that it has been a blessing to you. For more sermons, or if you have any questions, log on to www.fbcbelong.com.